Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I'm so happy today to bring you Rebecca Albiani. This is an interview I've been waiting for a long time because I've been a fan of Rebecca's for a long time. She's an art historian, and she is well known on Vashon Island as well as in Seattle and in the Puget Sound area. So before I say more, Rebecca, thank you so much. We finally connected, and I can't wait to talk with you.
It's my pleasure.
You know, I was thinking about what people would think if you said, I'm going to talk to an art historian, or I'm going to go to an art history lecture. And I bet there's some people carry the legacy of, oh, that is going to be dusty. You know, and they can imagine being in the back row of this class that they were forced to take in order to have a little culture in college. And they saw some good slides from the Renaissance and tried to stay awake.
I slept through my share of art history courses in college.
Yeah. And what amazes me, really amazes me, is that you can hold our attention for an hour or an hour plus with your art history talks. I mean, typically I don't even like lectures, but I love yours because there's something about your relationship to the material and what you're bringing to us that brings it alive. So first of all, kudos. I don't know how you do it, but it's a real gift, one, to be able to deliver a great lecture, and two, to make art so alive.
Thank you. Thank you. That's what I try to do.
So how does one become an art historian? And not only an art historian, but as I understand it, most of your art history talks have been outside of a university setting. You've been affiliated for years with the Frye Museum in downtown Seattle. You've been a part of their series. They have loved you. You've been giving talks to the Vashon Center for the Arts for years. They love you. But it's kind of like art historian with, you know, will travel with portfolio, but not, when I think art historian, I think of somebody who's sort of in the, on the fourth floor of the university office, you know, down in one of the Hinter buildings, but not you. So how did you come into this career?
So it's hard for me not to say I'm not a real art historian.
Okay, you because are, but you can say that, you know.
The way that I came into this career was via essentially failing at traditional art history. I never finished my dissertation. I worked on it for some years. My institution was Stanford. There's no Renaissance art in the Bay Area. So that was mistake number one, was not going to the East Coast or going somewhere where I would have real objects to look at.
Because Renaissance art was your
yes,
area.
It was 16th century Venice, images of Old Testament heroines from Veronese and Tintoretto. There was a short period in my life where I knew just about as much as anyone on the planet about this small topic that I had chosen. And I moved to first Washington, D.C., and then spent a year in Venice, largely in the archives, combing through, reading handwritten 16th century Italian, sort of mixed with Latin and Venetian, and trying to get a handle on these paintings that interest me, that still interest me. And Then when I got home, my advisor had left Stanford. I never really clicked with his replacement. I was living in Seattle. My husband and I married, and he got a job at the University of Washington. And I was trying to work on my dissertation, but I felt like I would come home every day and write the same paragraph over and over. And I was having terrible migraines. And I took a temporary job just so that I would get out of the house, because I wasn't leaving the house. I didn't know anyone, and I was just working on my dissertation. Had I been smart, I would have gone to, had I been less socially anxious, I would have gone to the university. I would have gone to Seattle U. I would have introduced myself to anyone who might have provided community, and to other graduate students who were struggling with their own dissertations, but I didn't have those social skills. And I was terrified to go introduce myself to total strangers. And I just didn't have the executive function skills, the organization and whatnot, to write a dissertation, to write this, you know, a book. Mm-hmm. And,
well, and it's also, you know, I don't know how it was for you, but having been in two doctoral programs, mm-hmm. you realize that one was a traditional one in a University of Michigan. The light at the end of the tunnel is to be in this increasingly arcane niche, researching something to death that only a few people in the world will know about, which is why you qualify to do a dissertation on it.
Yes.
But that specialization then distances you more and more from what regular people want to know, because you become an expert in something that is very, very small. And that's not necessarily interesting to a lot of us.
No. And in the 1990s, there was a movement that has really not ended within the humanities of very abstruse language. Post-structuralist theory, Derrida, Foucault, and so forth. And it distances the potential audience even further from learning what I find interesting about art. I didn't want to write in a way that my family couldn't understand. I don't want to talk in a way that my family, no, I did not come, I came from a smart family, but not an intellectual family.
Oh, and I get it. I mean, when I was in sociology, I felt like, why do you keep inventing five syllable words when nobody's going to understand that? You're almost inventing them so that nobody else will understand them.
Yes,
so that you
it
prove
makes you
your
sound
worth.
Smarter.
And
I wanted to teach, I wanted to connect. And so I dropped out of my graduate program and started getting regular aerobic exercise, and the migraines largely went away. And then, simultaneously, I had been starting to work as a docent at, not at Seattle Art Museum, but at the Fry Art Museum. So when I moved to Seattle in 96, I called Seattle Art Museum and asked about their docent program. And they told me that they train docents every 2 years, and the class of 96 was full, and would I be interested in the class of 98? And I said, thank you, I'll think about it, but that just seemed an awfully long way away. And so I called the Fry Art Museum. And what they told me was they had never had a docent program. And it was 96, it was when the building was closed. And the old Fry, which I never saw, was being converted into the building that is there now. And so they told me that they wanted to have a docent program that would start when the building opened. And so I had the opportunity to be one of the first Fry docents.
And just in case people are hearing this from outside the area, I mean, the Fry is an interesting museum because it's one, it was set up to always be available to the public. It's, you can go there for free, which is amazing. Yes. They have a very traditional collection in the back room. And then they have amazing front room collections. And I don't even know how to categorize them. Often very varied, edgy, diverse, you know, interesting. It's an interesting juxtaposition. How would you describe the Fry, just so that people have a context for what you're talking about?
It is exactly what you were saying, but apparently before 1996, when it was, you know, between, I don't know, I want to say 1940s when it opened and 1996, it was a small free art museum. They had paintings of ducks and cows and 19th century landscape paintings where you never had to strain your brain to figure out what it was that was being depicted. They did shows of local watercolor competitions. It did not apparently feel as high art as Seattle Art Museum, which is the main art museum in Seattle. But a little funky. People loved it because it's near the hospitals. It's in a part of Seattle called Pill Hill because it's surrounded by hospitals and people who were getting treatment at Swedish, at Virginia Mason, at Harborview would go, or their loved ones would go spend an hour in front of the ducks at the Fry. And it was a place of refuge for people. Since it reopened, its mission has changed a few times. That's been almost 30 years now. And at first they said it was a museum devoted to representational art. That has since gone out the window. And there's a lot of things on the walls now that the Frys themselves would not perhaps have recognized as art at all. The Fry is what has given me my career. I started as a docent, and one of my fellow docents became the museum educator. And at the time, she was living in Snohomish, and she asked me to do a talk that I think the first talk I did there was related to my dissertation project, because the Fry has a painting of Susanna and the elders. And Susanna is one of my Old Testament women. It's a theme that Veronese and Tintoretto both painted, and you know, Rubens and Rembrandt. And so I did a whole talk about that for a bouquet of flowers. And then Anita Halstead asked me if I would give a lecture in a series of, they were doing an art history class. She had already taken the Renaissance for herself. So she asked if I would teach Baroque. And they had someone else to do 18th century and someone else to do 19th century. And I was really uneasy at the thought of teaching Baroque because it's not my field. My field is late Venetian Renaissance. My field is like 20 years before the Baroque. But I was nervous, very nervous about teaching so far outside of my comfort zone. So I did the Baroque talk and Anita said, I'm never doing Renaissance again. It's yours now. Started thinking, I think, about how to use my my abilities as a lecturer, which, you know, I did speech and debate in high school. I wasn't allowed to be an altar girl when I was, you know, after First Communion back in the 70s, because I did not have the right equipment to be an altar boy. And so the priest said, well, you can't do that, but you could be a lector. And so in second grade, I started to do the second reading in church. So I have a long history of public speaking. It's what I do well. And so Anita came up with this idea of a dinner and art series. I think we did six lectures and we collaborated with the director of the cafe at that time. And he made meals that were related to the talks I gave. And I did a talk on Renaissance ceramics, and I did Dutch still life. I did Impressionist picnic. So it was great. We had a lot of fun. We had a great audience. We charged way too little. So the cafe director said he would never do it again. It was much too much work. Oh, and Anita's sister did these fabulous place settings for the tables. It was so great. And when that ended, Anita said, well, we can't do that, but let's do dessert and art. And we brought in desserts, and I started to give, you know, monthly or maybe a few blocks of 3 months here, 3 months there. But we outgrew the upper studio where we originally were giving these talks and moved downstairs into the auditorium and made it a year-round lecture series. And more or less, for the last 25 years or so, at least September through June, I've been doing a different lecture every month at the Fry. And forget stretching to the Baroque. I've stretched to, this year I did late classic Maya. I don't know anything about Maya art, but I learned enough to present it to my public.
This is Sally Fox, and we're listening today to Rebecca Albiani, Vashon's favorite art historian and a frequent lecturer at Vashon Center for the Arts. As an example, why don't you tell us what you're going to be presenting on Vashon at the Performing Arts Center this year? I know you're going to do a Jacob Lawrence.
Jacob Lawrence, I have actually lectured on a lot because Jacob Lawrence is a kind of Seattle hero. Yes. So I've talked in the past about his early series paintings, his Harriet Tubman, his Frederick Douglass. I've talked about his migration scene series. But at Vashon, because there is a show right now at Seattle Art Museum of Jacob Lawrence's work, I'll do a sort of all-purpose Jacob Lawrence lecture and talk about his whole career. Here in Seattle. So he was a beloved teacher at the UW. And even though he's really a Harlem artist, he's claimed as a Seattle artist.
We claim it. Yeah. And we have it. And then you're doing Joyce Scott, who's an artist I have never heard of, which I also love because you have, I mean, maybe if I was more of an art connoisseur, I would know these things, but you have actually introduced me to art that I wouldn't have known otherwise.
Which I love doing. And it is not something I would have done were I teaching in a university, or at least I would have introduced people to maybe artists from 1560 that they had never heard of. But I get to introduce people to contemporary artists.
And there's one, Ai Weiwei. How do you say that?
Ai Weiwei is a really important Chinese dissident artist.
Oh, wow.
He lives now in Berlin, I believe. He is persona non grata in China. Uh-huh. He's most famous, I think, for a performance work in which he drops and breaks a Ming vase. But he is an artist who, when he lived in China, was a perpetual thorn in the side of the Chinese Communist Party. He made art about, the death of children in earthquakes because of government overlooking safety regulations, and about freedom of expression and so forth. And he's a really important internationally known artist who's coming to Seattle Art Museum in a show that is being organized by the Seattle Art Museum in the spring. So it was almost literally a stop the presses moment. I was going to do a talk on a different artist, and the Vashon people saw the announcement from Seattle Art Museum that Ai Weiwei will be showing, and so asked me if I could pivot, and I will definitely be presenting Ai Weiwei to a lot of audiences. So from my Fry audience, which has been going on now for more than a quarter of a century, I began to get invitations to speak here or there. Can you come to my retirement community? Can you speak here at Mirabella, at Merrill Gardens, et cetera? And Anita Halstead retired from the Fry Museum and moved to Vashon and tried for years to get me to come to Vashon, and I had small children and it was too far. And finally I agreed that I would come to Vashon, and it's become a great joy for me to come to Vashon.
Yeah, because you've gone from being a couple times or a few times a year to a regular. You're like a rock. In the talks on the rock, you are the foundational rock. Yeah. Well, this is good, because I was wondering how, given the range, really, the range of centuries, genders, art genres and stuff that you talk about, do people make a request for a particular topic like a VCA made, or do you pick stuff because it's just interesting to you?
I mainly pick stuff because it is just interesting to me. But I also, because people like to hear me talk about what's at SAM. If they have the opportunity to go to Seattle Art Museum and see the show, they feel better prepared. Particularly when it is a lesser known artist, like for instance, Joyce Scott, who I will be doing in the fall. That's why we chose that topic, because that's the major fall exhibition at Seattle Art Museum.
Well, how do you prepare? Let's say you're going in to do a talk on an artist you don't know that well. I know on the presentation side, it always comes out like you are a little bit in love with the artist, and that radiates. You find something that's really cool, even though sometimes these people were difficult or may have had their quirky side, or you might not have actually liked them in person. You bring them alive. So it's their art and also the context that you set for it. Do you have like a little guide in your own mind for how you prepare a talk or start your research?
So I check out everything I can from the Seattle Public Library about that artist. Sometimes that isn't sufficient. Sometimes I need to go to the University of Washington Library. But I get a good start with the Seattle Public Library. So I check out books, and I do all of the internet research I can. I listen to podcasts. There are very often, if I'm working on a contemporary artist, there are very often interviews online. And so I listen to interviews. When I was working on Alexander Calder, which was one of my best attended talks on Vashon in this last season, Calder was having an exhibition at Seattle Art Museum. In fact, a local collector gave a very generous gift of Calder's to Seattle Art Museum. And so I talked about Calder on Vashon, on Whidbey, at various retirement communities around Seattle. There were, there weren't really interviews with him because he died before the internet age, but there were symposia, other scholars talking about Calder and so forth. So I can even put on my headphones and walk around Green Lake and be listening to information about an artist that I will be working on. And then I start. So sorry.
Oh, I was just wondering how long. This sounds like a really extensive. You're not doing a dissertation here.
No,
but
I'm
how
not
long
doing
do you
a dissertation.
Spend creating an hour talk?
I have never quantified that because I used to think it would be discouraging, but it depends on how intensively I'm working. I put together a talk on a show that's at the Fry right now that I gave, today's Tuesday, I gave yesterday for the first time. And I'll give again Friday at a different retirement community. But that one, I really, it was just a couple of weeks of effort for that one. But I also have maybe slightly lower standards for the retirement communities than I do for the big stage at Vachon or at the Fry in particular. And often Vachon, the talks that I present at Vachon, I have already presented at the Fry. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I will develop a talk for Vachon, but often they are ones that I have already, I've already put the work into. And then I listen to myself giving the original talk and, go back to my notes to refresh my memory. Sometimes I will reread something, but usually there's enough in there.
It must be challenging because when I think of the audience, for example, on Vachon or imagine the one at the Fry, you have this mix of people who are very educated and maybe artists themselves or have their own specialty in art history. So they're coming with this whole background. And you have people who are basically in off the street who have never even heard of the person that you're talking about and have a very minor relationship to art history, but are kind of curious. And you have to kind of invite them both in and make it accessible to everyone, but also not shortchange the people who are already somewhat knowledgeable. That, to me, that is, that's a great challenge.
It's a lot of fun. I assume that my audience is intelligent, but has no prior knowledge of what it is I'm talking about. And if I'm doing something like the Taj Mahal or, the Maya or the Olmec or, one of my out there talks that I do partly just to challenge myself. Partly the Maya was related to a contemporary artist who was showing at the Fry at that time, but I didn't need to do it. I chose to do it. Mm-hmm. But I always have this nagging anxiety that there's going to be the world expert on Maya civilization or at one time it actually happened. It usually doesn't. So that it leads me to over-prepare.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite parts of my presentations is the question and answer period at the end. And I love having artists in my audience because sometimes they can answer the questions that I can't answer. If I get a question about some technical aspect of photography or a particular medium or something that I'm not versed in, very often there is someone in the audience who can, say, well, in my experience, encaustic does this or whatever it is.
So interesting. Yeah. Well, what fuels, I can feel your excitement and I'm kind of learning junkie. So I kind of get this piece of just getting fascinated. getting interested in knowing about a topic and sort of falling in love with it. This is Sally Fox, and we're listening today to Rebecca Albiani, Vashon's favorite art historian and a frequent lecturer at Vashon Center for the Arts. What fuels your creative spark? I'm so interested in how people, you know, fuel their own spark and keep it going over a long period of time. And you've been at this for 25 plus years. How do you fuel yourself? And what keeps your creative spark going?
Traveling to see art is really important for me. I very often will see something in a museum and think, wow, that's extraordinary. People need to know about that. And then that will lead to a future talk. Or just get me excited again about seeing art. And here in the Pacific Northwest, we do not have the wealth of art collections that they have even in San Francisco, certainly not Los Angeles, but nothing compared to the East Coast, DC, New York, Chicago even. You know, there are some fabulous museums in places like Detroit and Pittsburgh that are much, much richer in, say, old master paintings than Seattle is. So we don't have that here. And it's part of what I do is making up for that lack, you know, bringing it virtually or, you know, via the PowerPoint, what used to be via the slide projector and the 35 millimeter slides, but, you know, on the big screen. And
yeah, that's a huge gift, especially when part of your audience will never be able to travel to these places. And really, who can travel to all of them? And how to get excited, you know, because also the other thing is that when people go to museums, and I've been guilty of this myself, there's the glaze factor. You know, you have 2 hours to do the Art Institute of Chicago and you want to hit the big ones. But then there's this kind of, I don't know, this fog that comes over where you're just trying to see what you can, moving not too fast, but moving pretty fast and never really looking at anything. And well, you look at stuff, but not really looking.
Not long enough.
Not long enough.
Not long enough.
And I think a lot of us have been trained in the glaze factor. You know, you see groups going to museums and that's how they go, you know.
Yes. And I am guilty of that sometimes, but I try to stop and give things my attention when I can. And I have found that very few people have my, I'm not sure stamina is the right word, but I can gladly spend all day in a museum. I do not want to leave. A close friend of mine, we went to the Met together once, and she introduced the concept of stopping mid-morning and getting a cup of coffee and a pastry to be fresher. And so I've started, you know, not making it a death march through every single gallery.
I like your friends. That's the way I would love to do it is,
yeah.
Or if you couldn't, you know, I was listening to a writer who was in Florence, but she was living there. So she could go to, is it the Uffizi Gallery? You know,
yes.
And she knew how to go in and where to go. And she could go in, be with it and leave. And do that multiple times. I thought, oh my gosh, that's a whole nother relationship to the art than feeling like I've got my 5 hours in Florence. I've got to
right.
take in
exactly
everything I can. But I think one of the gifts that you give people, because I remember your lecture on Hokusai and the Great Wave, is that people, you know, you go in and you have this background that in a sense asks you to pause because you know some of the context, you know some of what went into it, you know, so that alone slows you a bit, there's a kind of reverence of thinking, oh, I've heard about this and I know this and I know how long it took and I know how many assistants and I know the importance of this work. And that alone just like,
And if I have 60 slides in an hour presentation, and usually I have more, but still, but some of them are just, quick illustration of something. If someone looks at an image on the screen while I'm talking about it for 60 seconds, that's more than most people spend in front of any work in a museum. I mean, I think they've calculated the average to be 13 seconds, something like that, that people spend in front of a work of art. So even a minute is better. And hopefully that gets people excited to look at something for even longer. I mean, in an ideal world, we would all live in Florence and live
Just
to go.
have really good long stays there so that we
Or,
could.
I lived in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years, and most of the museums in D.C. are free. And so you can go. And this was before 9/11, so it was before having to go through the metal detectors and everything. But you could go and sit down in front of a work on your lunch hour if you chose. And just you didn't it didn't cost anything, and you could really learn a work of art, really make a friend of it. And I think having a museum membership is good for that, even if we don't have the same caliber of, old master painting here that I was, there's a Leonardo in the National Gallery.
Well, the Seattle Art Museum is kind of like my local library was. You could get great books, you just couldn't expect to get everything there. So you went and you saw, it was more like, what do they have that will be wonderful, as opposed to expecting that there'll be everything or every
And that it
genre
will
there.
be in any way encyclopedic.
A couple more questions for you. I'm just fascinated by what you do. You're also, you sketch or you draw. Are you
I
an
do draw.
artist in other ways? And how does being an art observer, researcher, historian, interact with your own artistry?
This is another place where I will tell you that I am not a real artist. I have plenty of friends who are real artists, and I sketch, I draw, and I do watercolors, and I was not the kid growing up who was always doodling. I was much more, I might be writing stories. I was not making pictures. And I had to take an art class as an undergraduate. It was a prerequisite for an art history major, and it was fairly traumatizing. And it put me off of future art classes for a long time. And then I was feeling like it would be helpful and that it would use a different part of my brain than I'm, than the research part and the the putting things together part. And I came across a quote from an art historian I admired who said that he didn't trust an art historian who couldn't draw and couldn't dance. It's like, well, I can dance okay, but I definitely can't draw. And I took a drawing class at continuing education at the local community college. And the teacher said, this is a hand-eye coordination skill. You do it more, you get better at it. You may never be Raphael, but you will get better if you practice. And that was just really encouraging. And because I'm one of those people that it's hard for me to do things that I'm not good at, to try new things and look like an idiot. And, you know, my early creations are not terribly exciting, but then I had kids and didn't do it for a lot of years. And, you know, every once in a while I would take a class and it would be like, I like this. But it wasn't until maybe the last 10 years that I've been drawing a little more seriously. And I enjoy it. I enjoy it. That is why I do it. I do not do it for any other reason except that it gets me out of the stress, the political situation, that you cannot think about any of those things when you are trying to get the angle of that leaf right. And so it just puts me in a different place.
I get so much of what you're talking about, both the way that art classes can actually ruin people for making art, and also the fact that there's a place where when we can get out of the who's the real artist, because I don't even like that question. You know, I think it robs us of the ability to make art for the pure joy of it. When we have to discern, yeah, if you're competing to get into a museum, yeah, who's the real artist that might apply? But for most of us, can't we just go back and find that childhood? I just want to make things. I want to create. I want to experience art. And I want to look at art, because it's really like, it's where we started the conversation. It's like art history is not just for dusty old people. You know, art history can be very dynamic and can actually open your eyes to the world. Yeah. And so can making art. And not just because you're knowledgeable or effete or professional, you know, all those other things, you know. So if you were to make a pitch for the importance, you've already started it, by the way, but for the importance of the rest of us opening our eyes to looking at art, maybe creating art in this time where the world is going through hell and we are so at risk and it breaks your heart. So some might say, you know, why are you doodling when the world is burning? And then others could say, I'm doodling because the world is burning, you know, because it keeps me sane. What would you pitch in terms of why art, looking at it and making it, might just be really important right now?
It's something that I've thought about a lot, because I have a nephew who just graduated from Berkeley in nuclear physics, and he wants to end climate change, and he thinks that the only way to do that is with nuclear energy. And he's doing something that is undeniably globally important. And I feel like you say, you know, that I'm doing something that is a little frivolous. But I have had so many people say that, you know, that lecture at the Fry is their favorite day of the month, or that when I come into their retirement community, they would never miss it. You know, it's their favorite thing, that it brings joy. And, you know, if I'm an artist, that is my art. I create art history lectures that are works of art. And in doing so, I get to talk about the greatest creations of the human spirit. Now, I've never done prehistoric art. Someday I will do a talk on prehistoric art, but, you know, from ancient Minoans onward, the impulse, the very, very human impulse to make meaning through imagery, to make beauty, to adorn ourselves and our environments, it is part of every human culture. And if we deny its importance, we are denying something fundamentally human. In the last 100 years or so, art has also been, and longer, but art has also been something that makes us think critically and think in a new way sometimes about the world, about politics. Some of my favorite artists are socialists. William Morris comes to mind. William Morris, who made flowered wallpaper and wanted to make the world better and in a more equitable place. So if I'm there, I might as well quote William Morris, because William Morris said, "I do not want art for a few any more than education for a few or freedom for a few." And that for me is recognizing that art is a fundamental human right, just like education, just like, you know, it's a little maybe less basic than food and shelter, but it's there and we need it. And if it helps us keep going when times are dark, if I can bring joy to people, because I try to make my talks not just educational, but actually entertaining. And if I can do that, I feel like, okay, I'm not solving climate change or world hunger or curing cancer, but I'm bringing a little light into the world.
A world that needs that so much. So
yeah.
Thank you for that. I, you know, your words are really moving and I'm like 110% behind them, you know. I so agree. For folks who are either not in the area or can't easily go to lectures, are some of your lectures available online where people could perhaps find them either through a particular institution or through YouTube? Do you know if there's anything?
Yes, very many of them through Voice of Vashon. So they have some of my lectures, some that are not of the quality that I feel like my standards continually increase. But they have some recent ones. I got an Instagram message from someone in Ecuador asking me to interpret a Hendrik Overkamp painting that was the cover of a book he had purchased, you know, a book in Spanish. And, you know, I knew the painting. I could easily answer the question. I did, and I added, "What on earth made you pick me to ask this question to?" And he had, I guess he'd Googled Overkamp and found my Vashon video on YouTube. And
amazing.
So, yeah, it is, isn't it?
It is. It is. Well, I'll put a link and I'll put a link to that. And right now I both have a show on Voice of Vashon and I have my own podcast. And I'm thinking we may go out in both channels because.
So, and here is another way that people who are interested, if they go on the Fry Art Museum website, and I can send you the link to that. I give the lectures now, both in person in the auditorium, and then they're recorded for a virtual audience. So during the pandemic, we went entirely virtual, and a lot of our audience was, say, on Vashon or on Bainbridge Island, or getting to the point where they don't like to drive in Seattle winter weather, and so forth. And so they choose to subscribe virtually. And so that's an option as well if you want to hear the talks that I'm developing in the future.
Well, that's fabulous. You know, and I can say, oh, You know, if you get one of those winter storms or you need to stay inside or you just can't travel, I can't think of a better way to spend an afternoon. So thank you so much for spending part of your afternoon. I again, you'll see me at the talks, but I am just delighted to go backstage with you right now. And
Oh, thank you so much, Sally. It was a real pleasure talking about what I do.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.